tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh, my God! Santa here? I know him.
This episode of Ringside is brought to you by Duraferm.
Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast.
What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and for the last time of the year, folks, I'm going to introduce the Scrooge, the Grinch. Never mind, she has her tree up. Danielle Caroli, what's up?
Crisis averted. You can rest easy. And I guess I should say Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Merry Christmas to you, Danielle.
Merry Christmas, John.
You have the tree. I have proof by being sent a Christmas tree, but did you guys decorate it or no?
Yes. The tree is up. The decorations are on and it is lit.
No.
Yes, I know. It's very hard for you to believe. I am aware. But yes.
We need a picture of you standing in front of it with that day's newspaper, and then I'll believe it.
First of all, there's an amazing thing called Photoshop. I could Photoshop any date on a newspaper. The other thing is, do newspapers even have printed copies anymore? Like, how do they do ransom notes?
They do ransom notes. The only reason I know that papers still print issues is the fact that we, like, three times a year, our daughter or our animals are in it. So we're like, oh, let's keep this for keepsake purposes.
Yeah, it's very hard to find papers around here. I mean, maybe if I do, like, New York Post or something, I could do one that's timestamped for you. It's just not worth the effort. At some point, you have to believe what your co-host tells you and trust her word, because that is what is behind a true successful podcast.
Well, what's going to be behind a true successful Merry Christmas for me is if my dough hail is in heat today or not. So it might be a Merry Christmas for somebody.
Beautiful transition.
Oh. Right?
So what's going on in your barn, John?
Anxiously waiting to see if my dry yearling hail decides to come back into heat or remain, hopefully, settle. Besides that, Danielle, I have had the hopes of getting up into the barn and cleaning it out, but that doesn't seem like it's going to happen this weekend, as it's Christmas weekend, and yeah, right, big projects on a holiday weekend with a family? I don't know.
I don't need to make plans for the beginning of the year attending a funeral. Just don't have time for it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're lucky I was able to record this week, to be honest. But, yeah. But it's so funny. It's driving Tierney nuts because I'm like, she's like, okay, I got to go do shopping today. I'm like, all right, go ahead. We're recording this on the Saturday before Christmas, by the way, folks. So she's gone off and did a little bit of last minute shopping. Good luck to her. You know, Godspeed. And then I was like, hey, I got to record at like 11 a.m. Is that cool? And she's like, yeah, that's fine. I'll come pick up Alice. And Alice's thing for going on car rides lately is like, you have to tell her that she's going on an adventure. So I've turned it into, I can't remember what kid's show it is, maybe Bluey. Every time that they're like, Tierney's like, okay, we're going on an adventure. I'm like, we're going on an adventure. And Alice does the same. All of a sudden, Alice will be like, I'm going on an adventure. So, like, just, we're driving Tierney nuts with our two crappy Australian accents.
I feel like I'm a broken record, but I'm going to say it. Your poor wife. My hat's off to her.
I'm going to have to do, like, some TikToks of us going to a show. We're going on an adventure.
Yes, you certainly will.
So thank you, Tierney, for letting me record this week. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure that everybody is totally tuning in because they're not busy opening presents. Hopefully they got some awesome gifts from our awesome Christmas list that we put together for everybody this year. Seems like everybody enjoyed it and people were actually utilizing it.
Couldn't agree more. We thank everybody who checked it out, also clicked on those links and bought things because it helps us. And then also we had a lot of fun putting it together. And then everybody who bought things from our merch store, we appreciate it as well.
Yeah. Danielle was telling me, folks, that so many people use the link that she thinks she can buy herself a cup of coffee now.
I'm living high on the hog, John. Living high on the hog.
That's right. You know, we're just slabbing the old bacon together. We're living high on the hog.
Danielle, what's going on with you pre-Christmas? Like, you guys doing okay?
Oh, we're doing great. It's all is calm. All is bright in our barn.
Boo.
I know I kind of went off the deep end. I believe it was last episode on this wonderful tangent, I guess we could call, about my does and just what the heck are we doing with our lives. It's amazing how a week later, I'm in a totally different spirit about it all.
Do tell what's going on that you're all of a sudden seeing the light.
Seeing the light. Well, drinking the Kool-Aid might be a better way to put it.
Uh-oh.
I got blood results back on the latest batch of Are They Pregnant? This was the group. I believe I had 5 does that we drew blood on. I really couldn't have asked for a better result back, all things considered. I had 2 does open out of the 5. One was my fence jumper, or what I thought was a through the fence breeding. And then ironically, I think she was in heat yesterday. So I'm like, oh, well, that was a waste of a blood test. At least I know she's not pregnant, which is good because I just didn't need her pregnant. I have 1 doe that came back open. She came back into heat 2 days ago, and so she was able to be bred, but we were able to watch for her heat and catch that. She's probably, in terms of if I were to rank all of my does, she's definitely one of the low men on the totem pole. So while it would be cool to have her bred, there's not this huge pressure to get her bred because she's going to be vital to the showstring. I also decided to breed her one more time to see if we can get her bred because it is better for her. But I also gave her... Yeah. Says you. You're just trying to like make us have like a 2024 bet where like, who can have the shortest kidding season? Oh, look, I cheat. I win. Or something like that along those lines. Yes. So she's hopefully bred. I did give her a shot of Sister Ellen or GNRH because she's been bred naturally once. She first of all, I started her on a kind of full stink protocol. She was one of those does, and then she didn't take on that one, so she got bred naturally one more time. And then this cycle I decided to give her a little GNRH because basically after talking with Levi the other week, I kind of feel like we made the one part of her reproductive cycle as pretty as can be. And so now we're going to try and get that, like, get those eggs to release. We're going to see how it goes. Fingers crossed on that one. But why it was so exciting is because on this list of 5, so those were the 2 open, and again, good open and then not the end of the world open. I confirmed one of my does. We had bred her twice, but the first time was an AI and we bred her the second time. Wasn't too worried about her. She's starting to look like she's baking some babies. One of the does had a very silent heat. The only reason I knew she was in heat was because she had this ever so much discharge. One cycle we bred her, she didn't take. Second cycle, I was looking for that discharge again. No other outward signs of heat. Barely stood for the buck. I think both times we had him breed her once, and it's like holding her down. She wasn't in a great standing heat. It's amazing what can happen. And she is pregnant, so that is
a huge relief.
Because it's just, she's a hard one to catch, and that's probably why she was a dry 2-year-old and coming up. So she freshened first as a 3-year-old. Yeah, second, she's 4. She's going to be 4 this year. So that's exciting and just a sigh of relief.
Sorry to interrupt, but you could be really, like, festive and you could make up a song for her. So next year you can be like, Silent Heat, do it again, you go for me.
Yeah. I apologize to all the listeners. This is supposed to be our Christmas episode, John, and
that's why it was very, I thought that that was very festive.
It's very festive, yes, but I don't know if anybody wants to hear that.
Maybe not.
It's bad enough they're listening to us. Do they really want to hear us sing? I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Go on. Sorry, everybody.
That's okay. So then, drum roll.
Oh, wait. I might actually have one. Wait, hold on.
That's
No. Sorry.
All right. Forget the drum roll.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. All right. All right. Go on, Danielle. Sorry.
Wait, did you just boo me?
No, it was booing me.
Oh, okay. So, my experimental came back confirmed pregnant. I am very excited about that.
That's awesome.
I'm going to ultrasound her because she did come back confirmed pregnant last year, even though she had water pregnancy. But I did a quick look back. Unfortunately, with my blood work, it said 30 plus. So, I don't know. So for my 2022 blood work, it said 30 plus. So I have no idea when I drew blood versus when she was due. I probably could have figured that out, but I didn't dive that too deep into it. With that, her levels were very low. They were still in that pregnant range. They weren't in a recheck range, but they were very close to that recheck range. I'm thinking her levels this time are much higher. And I know the range really isn't that important. Like, it's not like, oh, she's closer to one instead of like 0.75 on this range. She's definitely carrying multiples. So that's not quite how it works. But I do know that if their levels are closer to recheck and you see problems later on, that it kind of gave you a hint that maybe they were absorbing a pregnancy, or maybe it was more of a water pregnancy, all of those kind of things. So hindsight's 2020 and live and learn, but we'll ultrasound her just to confirm it. And so I am once again hopeful. I am going to have babies that are going to be ready for takeoff. And we made some Snoobians. We will see what happens in about 4 months with that. But right now, I'm kind of on cloud nine with that and very excited for what's going to happen in 2024.
So are you going to scan her and, you know, ultrasound her and actually see, make sure it's not a water? Like, when are you planning on doing that?
So we are going to scan her and just make sure that we're seeing kind of that movement and all of that. Probably next week, if not the week after, I would think. I'd have to look at my sheet and how far along she is just by nature of holiday scheduling, but then also we're still kind of playing around with ultrasounding and we don't have the greatest results of seeing things. So when we're ultrasounding her, we want her to be a little bit farther along. I think we're pretty close to that good window for at least what our skill is allowing us to do on the ultrasound. So we're just going to see. I am hopeful.
Fingers crossed. I always enjoy going in the ring versus your grade sonnens and seeing
experimental.
Sorry.
There's a difference, sonnens. John.
There is a difference. I know. I'm sorry. I apologize. Anyway, I like going in the ring against them. It's fun. It's always a good time. So going in the ring against a Snoobian with those, I'm hoping, airplane ears, derpy look on their face, it'd be great.
She's going to be so pretty. I'm putting it out there, sending out the good vibes. I'm excited.
Danielle, we have a kind of different topic for the week. But before we get into that, I'm just going to reintroduce our sponsor for the week, which is Durafirm, created by Biozyme Incorporated. It is a line of nutritional supplements for sheep and goats that supports optimal digestion and nutrition for maximized performance at every stage of production. Both of us use DuraFirm Goat Concept Aid during breeding season and all year round. It's designed to support reproductive success. Danielle obviously is seeing a little bit of success as her goats are finally taking, and mine, it's wintertime. Their coats are supposed to look dull, but man, are they looking shinier than ever. Thank you so much to DuraFirm for sponsoring this episode of Ringside. And if you, the listener, would like to find a DuraFirm dealer near you, visit DuraFirm.com/ringside. Thank you, DuraFirm.
Yes, thank you, DuraFirm, for sponsoring. And I have to say, I installed that brush system for the goats to itch upon, and yes, they are loving it. What's really cool is my Nubians have so much kind of cashmere and fluff, but there's this one doe who is obviously kind of scratching her shoulder and her front side, and so the hair's a little thinner because she's lost that fluff from that side, and where she's kind of itching, her hair looks so good. And I just know it is the power of those DuraFirm minerals keeping her right where she needs to be, not only in terms of the breeding season and reproductive health, but also just making sure those minerals are balanced and she's living her best life.
They definitely looked like they were living their best life. That's for sure.
We try.
Since it is Christmas Day, we are enjoying what the world has brought to us, which is family, love, and cheer. And we decided, let's just pick out our top 10 episodes from the year. Kind of a rewind back. Danielle decided to pick 6 because she's an overachiever. So I'm going to let you go first, Danielle. On, I guess, are we ranking them our favorite, or are you just pulling out your favorite 6?
Oh, I just pulled out 6. I don't even know, honestly, John, if these are my favorite episodes, because I started looking back. I forgot what we did this year. I mean, I remembered we did all of these episodes and we had on all these great breeders, and then we've had some awesome conversations and brought in such amazing experts in this dairy goat field. But I didn't realize we did it all this year, honestly.
Yeah, it's insane to look back on, right?
It really is. And so I was scrolling back to start the year off and started kind of reviewing what we did. And I'm like, oh my God, this episode happened this year. I thought this was last year. We did this one and we did this one. I don't necessarily know if they are my top 6 favorite episodes or no. I did 6. You did. Oh, I read this wrong. Okay. So yes. So I have 6. John has 4. I don't necessarily know if they're my top 6 episodes, but I just love the moments that were part of these episodes and like these little clips that we are bringing you of them. Just wanted to kind of share them again. I guess my first one is from episode 150. Let's have an IVF party with Stephanie Milber Rovey. It is all about the power of the dairy goat community. Take a listen.
Perfect.
Well, speaking of those exciting additions, was it 7 months now or so you and several other breeders started this amazing collaboration that we want to discuss with you? And can you tell us a little bit about that project that happened on your farm?
Yeah, so it actually started longer than 7 months ago. So back in 2017, we served as a trial herd for IVF. And if you kind of know, I love science, I love biology. If you think about the differences between a fresh flush and IVF, we're not going in and super ovulating a doe and then either AIing her or live covering her and making embryos and then flushing them and then fresh transplanting them. We're actually aspirating the follicles off the ovary. And then those follicles go to a lab and get in vitro. So you can use multiple different sires if you collect enough ova off that doe. And it also gives the opportunity to split straws. So we can actually use, you know, one straw across multiple dose. So if you've got super valuable semen that, you know, maybe you've got one straw left of to your name, it's a fantastic option. And so we served as a trial herd back in 2017, and we used multiple breeds. We used multiple age groups. So one of the fun things about that original flush, I used 6-month-old doelings. I had a couple of those that we aspirated, and those does had children on the ground before they had ever given birth themselves.
That's so cool.
So just some fun science. And back in 2017, we went into it with zero expectations. So we were told that, you know, they were really focusing on making sure that the medium was correct and that the sedation drugs were, you know, we were an experiment. And so we didn't advertise that, and we did not go into it with any sort of expectations at all. And we were just participating for the data. That flush was incredibly successful and produced my national champion. So Grand Ronde AC chocolate chip, her sister chocolate tart, her other sister that passed cookie dough. Those were all part of the 2017 initial experiment. And then we kind of fast forward to 2019, and Dr. Acton approached me and she said, "Hey, are you interested in trying this again? Because I have some does that are going to be terminals, and this will be their last hurrah. They cannot carry a pregnancy, but do you think this would be an option to getting some last offspring out of them?" And we decided that yes. So in 2019, Lori and I flushed, and what I was so excited about that flush was that, you know, she didn't have enough recips to carry her own embryos, but I did. And on this commercial side, it was just an opportunity to use these incoming virgin doelings in a way that actually gave us more valuable offspring than they would carry themselves, and a chance to get them fresh, but also sort of experiment with it as well. So we did that. And the, what was the 2020 kids were also highly successful. So that was just a partnership between Dr. Acton and myself, just because, you know, you kind of have to go into this with the expectations have to be managed. At the end of the day, it's biology and it's science, and it is laparoscopic surgery. So, you know, things can go awry, and they have, and they do. So when you're participating, you also want to be careful to manage the outcomes. After the 2020 session, we had a couple other breeders that said, "Hey, we have does that for whatever reasons can't carry a pregnancy to term. They've got, you know, your uterine scarring, they're not an option for AI. We've got issues breeding here." One of our best donors in the history of this entire project has a chronic uterine infection. So her name's Eleni, and she's an Alenia daughter. One of the last actual De Rugistiel does still living and breathing. And she has had a chronic uterine infection that, you know, we cannot clear up now for 5 years, but she's an absolutely phenomenal donor doe. And you can still go in and aspirate the follicles off those ovaries, even though she can't carry a pregnancy.
Wow.
When we started looking at the opportunities for fellow breeders, it made my pulse race, because I thought, you know, you have to have a facility that is within driving distance to the lab, because these are on a time clock. You know, once we aspirate the ovaries, they need to get back up to the lab, get fertilized. It has to be at a location that can also be suitable for surgery. So we're actually, you know, sedating and intubating your donors, and the environment has to be controlled. You can't be doing this outside under a tent or, you know, in a building that doesn't have heat. So you need to be pretty temperature controlled and pretty climate controlled. And the more I was thinking about it, I have the facility to handle that. The lab is that we've been using is within driving distance. And so I kind of became a central location for this process. The other exciting part is for breeders that don't have very large herds, and maybe their incoming yearlings and two-year-olds are also next year's show does. You know, when you're doing laparoscopic surgery, you don't particularly want to use an incoming yearling that could be first place at nationals next year. But how ideal is it to use commercial does that are going back on a line and they're doing their job, but they can also perform this service before going over to the dairy?
I absolutely love that episode with Stephanie. It's just one that has a lot of information and also shows what the goat community is all about. I love that pick, Danielle. It's awesome. I guess if we're going to go with mine, one that kind of was like just a surprise to me was when we decided to sit down with Emily Morgan and her episode Seize the Day with Emily Morgan, which was 169. It was just inspiring, right? She decided to go out and help the Bices, Redwood Hills, and Nationals. She learned a lot from them. She had a great experience and then is bringing that back home with her herd. And just hearing how she's pulled up her bootstrap and gone for it and has seen success doing so, it's cool. It's such a fun story. I think everybody should listen to it.
Was it a stressful experience or was it pretty easygoing? You look at people at a national show and some breeders are just like, do, 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 do. And other breeders, they look like they're fighting themselves internally. Like, were you like walking on eggshells or were you pretty comfortable?
I mean, I think I was really comfortable with the people I was working with. Everybody was really amazing. You know, there were no cat fights or anything, or, you know, oh, you can't put the alfalfa in that direction because you won't eat it. You know, there was really no nitpicking or micromanaging that bothered me, I guess you could say. Of course, I was kind of on edge the entire time for the exact same reason you guys are talking about. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm working with Redwood Hill right now. Is this real? You know, every day I woke up and I was thinking, wow, this is crazy. So I guess you could say I was on edge because I wanted to perform my best and I wanted to be the best help I could be for them. Mm-hmm. But in a way, I think it almost encouraged me to, you know, think about things differently and things like that. And I wanted to do things exactly as they wanted to. So I wouldn't say I was stressed out, but I was definitely, you know, I was kept on my toes, and they were all really great and welcoming to me the entire time. So I didn't feel like I was, you know, having to walk on eggshells or anything.
Yeah.
No, you wanted to bring your A game because that was what was, you know, is basically, I guess, expected of you, that you were working with a herd who knew they were going to perform. And so that makes 100% sense.
Yeah.
So what was the best memory? I mean, you talk about, they had a fabulous national show, but for you, what was the best memory from this experience?
I would say my best memory was, this sounds probably kind of weird, but it was really just doing the normal things at Redwood Hill. Of course, I loved the national show and it was amazing that they won, and I loved all the does that they won with, but I really enjoyed waking up every day and milking with them. And that's something that I still think about, you know, now that I'm home and things like that. I really enjoyed that normal day to day because, as you know, someone like me with a really small herd, you think of these big herds that win consistently, almost like what do they do? And, you know, how do they do it? And look at that. And look at all they won again. And they keep winning and things like that. But then when you just think about the sort of the monotonous things that I think we overlook all the time, it kind of like blurs the image of who they are. So I personally, my favorite memory was just milking the girls every day, getting them on the parlor, you know, doing what they did best and doing what they were bred to do. So it's kind of stupid, I guess. It's not
no. You know,
the glorious moment of when my favorite goat on the farm, Titania, she's my favorite, she won. But really just milking every day is something I'll never forget and I'll hold true to my heart forever.
Listen, you are a true farm girl at heart, because when I think back when I was on the farm and we're talking about Holsteins, my favorite memories were in the milk parlor. Like, it just, those are the best times. Those are the times where you get to talk or listen to music, jam out. And it really was like just the best. And I think about those days fondly. So no, that's not stupid. That is most certainly an answer I wasn't expecting, but love.
So then my second moment, which I kind of wanted to put as my second, just because if you listen to the complete episode of Let's Have an IVF Party, and then there's like almost a little Easter egg in there about the animal in episode 177, A Living Legacy, Tempo Aquila's Frozen in Time ET with Dr. Acton, our spotlight sale feature, that Stephanie was kind of dropping a hint that there was a very good possibility we were going to see this animal in the spotlight sale, which is why I wanted to put it next. But Dr. Acton, we kind of went off script in this episode, in this part. And there's always this debate. Does a buck have to be pretty? Can he look horrible and still produce gorgeous animals? And where does the buck look conformationally? And I know different breeders have all different philosophies on this, but I just loved picking Dr. Acton's brain and just her thoughts on the weaving of the pedigree and how an animal is supposed to appear.
I want to ask, because I want to back up just a bit, and this is more because we have an opportunity to pick your brain, but one of the things you said about Frozen, and I just want to kind of get your insight into this, is that he is an incredibly correct buck, and you just really love the appearance of him. And I feel like there's different trains of thoughts on bucks. How much weight do you put into what their phenotype is for what you see in their daughters? I know this is kind of off script, but just out of curiosity, in your bucks, do you want them to be correct in that general appearance and correct in the body capacity and dairy strength, or like, do you want them, I guess, do you want that, or is it more of what they produce at the end?
Okay, for me, Jeanette, well, for me, as a person who's shown goats and, again, had a commercial dairy, and I guess we really haven't delved in on the milk production on these animals either, but this is a female industry, period. There is no, and not to get but too crude point on it, but the males are only life supports for a penis. And that's all they are. They're out there making sperm to make doe kids. And so how much do I put on phenotype on a buck? Nothing. Everybody loves to look at a good buck. Now, I'm going to kind of take a little reservation in that. Bucks like to self-destruct. And so bucks, and they tend not to get their feet trimmed as much as other creatures, and you know, they tend to be out there, and for us, we like to run our bucks a bit wild, so they're out there on 5 acres of pasture, as they, not the buck kids, but the older bucks. So, you know, they may or may not stand up to that quite as much as somebody who lives in a stall and is fed alfalfa all the time. But a young buck, I like to see a correct young buck, and I like any animal to look like its pedigree says it should. I would worry if Frozen was a massive kid. I would worry if Frozen was extremely wide. I would worry if Frozen wasn't sharp and angular, because that's not his pedigree. And that means he's not genetically sound. So I'm going to look at a buck kid in any animal, but a buck kid especially, to make sure that he follows his pedigree. He looks like his pedigree should look, and he should be correct. Because correctness is what is, you know, first and foremost about Living Free. That's the first thing that you ever saw about her was, oh my gosh, you know, she's this is what a front end is. Or, you know, I remember the appraiser when she's, I can't remember which one it was, one of them anyway. So he was going along and he was scoring her and he's like, oh, and she's got A feet, because a lot of our dogs have A or lesser feet, because I don't actually really trim feet as much. I believe that I like a functional foot. And so, you know, and that's fine. I don't really care. And then I said, and then we walked her over on some concrete for, I can't remember, for some other reason. And he looks at it, he says, wait a minute, those are E feet. Where did those come from? Like, well, I trimmed this one. And so, you know, that's kind of what I want to see in a buck, because I want to see that correctness coming through. I want to see his phenotype look like his pedigree says the phenotype should look. And he's line bred on Yukon Jack, and he doesn't actually look like Jack, but he looks like Jackie. Jack's perhaps most popular daughter. I'm not going to say most famous or best. I'm just going to say most popular daughter, because Jackie was incredibly popular. And she was just really an amazing individual in terms of personality and just the number of people that he touched. And he looks and acts like Jackie. He could be a Jackie son. He's a Jackie sister, but he could be a Jackie son. So that's what I'm going to look for in a young animal. But I'm not going to keep them based on that. If I get an absolutely gorgeous buck kid out of an absolutely average doe, that isn't going to mean a thing to me. He's still going to go the same place where all buck kids out of average does go. Because I'm going to pick my kids based on them breeding. And the same thing's true with doe kids. I'm going to pick my doe kids in October when I breed those does. And I'm going to pick out which kids, and if they get born, I keep them. And if they don't get born, I don't keep somebody else instead. And that's where I think that's where the consistency in our herd and just the timelessness has happened, is that I don't often get swayed by a pretty face.
My next episode is 161, Dealing with Parasites, with Dr. Katie Jackson, DVM. And she is just awesome, well-spoken. I know that everybody's thinking about kidding season, and with that, in turn, a lot of times when the doe kids, you see a rise in the parasite load. So it's something you got to start thinking about, something you might want to listen to and go back onto.
Let's talk about treatment, since we have a vet on here to actually talk about it. Obviously, we're going to be talking in a general sense, but if you have a client experiencing issues, what is your typical recommendation for treatment? What kind of plan are you giving them? And is it a multiple dewormers or repeat dosage? What do you usually throw at them?
So for barber pole worm, which, like I said, is the main one that I'm worried about around here, I'll do what's called a double dewormer protocol. And that's currently what's recommended by that ACSRP, that American Consortium for Small Ruminant Parasite Control Program. They're recommending deworming with two different classes of dewormers. So your macrocyclic lactones or your ivermectins and cydectins, and then something like a white wormer like valbazin or safeguard. So usually the one I'll reach for is kind of the hardest hitting, and that'll be cydectin and valbazin. Obviously, you're not supposed to use valbazin in early pregnancy animals, so I might reach for a safeguard type product instead of valbazin in those cases. But pretty much always I'm going to be doing that double deworming protocol. I'll usually throw in a copper oxide wire particle too. That's something for sure to talk to your vet about, because especially if you're already feeding loose minerals or doing multi-min or something like that, you want to kind of be aware of what level of copper these animals are at. But there's been some evidence to suggest that those copper oxide wire particles, once they get into the ablation, they can physically pierce that barber pole worm. And so that's a way that we can kind of kill off some of those worms without contributing to resistance to some of our chemical dewormers. And if those animals are really, really bad off and they're off feed, I'll add in some supportive care like some dexamethasone, some B vitamins, probiotics, and then I'll give them some red cell too, just to kind of throw a little bit of iron at them and help them build that red blood cell supply back up. Coccidia, they're a little bit different. My big thing on those guys is just primarily prevention and trying to keep those levels low to begin with. So keeping your environment clean, which we'll talk about a little bit later, decox in their feed, or else you can do CAFPRO in their bottles, things like that. So I usually kind of err on the side of trying to get those kids on some kind of coccidia stat program. There's a few questionably legal treatment options out there. Really, the only ones that are unquestionably legal are going to be those five-day protocols. So Corid's a good example. And then Tolcrazyril and Pinazyril are kind of some questionable ones. So Marquee, which is Pinazyril, is actually a legal option for coccidia if you can prove resistant to other products that are already approved for food animals. Tolcrazyril, on the other hand, which is a metabolite of Pinazyril, or other compounded products similar to it, are not going to be legal because food animals are not allowed to use compounded products. So that might be why if you talk to your vet about what options they want you to have, some of them probably aren't going to let you have Tolcrazyril because that kind of puts their license on the line. But depending on what your situation is, they might let you do Pinazyril. So coccidia, I would definitely recommend talking to your vet, see what's working in your area, and kind of what their recommendations are. And then meningeal worm, once again, kind of a whole different situation. I use a five-day protocol of high-dose fenbendazole. So that's the one choice, one place where I will reach for a safeguard. And I'll usually also do an initial dose of cydectin or ivermectin as well. But that five-day dose of safeguard is the important thing because that's what's going to cross the blood-brain barrier and actually take care of that parasite as far as killing it. We've also got to think about managing the inflammation that that worm's created as it's moving through that spinal cord, because even though we kill the parasite, if we don't keep down the inflammation, it's going to be kind of hard for that animal to recover well. So I'll usually also do Dex if they're not pregnant, and probably Meloxicam, as well as other supportive care like B vitamins.
Yeah, Dr. Katie Jackson is just definitely a wealth of knowledge, and we are so appreciative of having her on and having her be one of our returning guests. Another episode I really enjoyed was episode 135, 50 plus years of dairy goats with Jennifer Bice. And one of the things I really thought was interesting, because I feel like so often people, when they're concerned about commercial dairies versus show herds, is, can I have animals that do both? And as Jennifer Bice explained in her clip, you can and you should. And I'll let you listen to her words about it.
I want to ask, because obviously there is the business side of it, and then there's the herd side of it. And as we mentioned in the introduction, there have been many national champions, class winners, insane animals that have lived on that Redwood Hills farm. But balancing the business side of the creamery and being a dairy versus having this successful show herd, do you ever run into issues where dairy's needs hinders your breeding stock, or your breeding stock hinders your dairy needs?
No, we don't, because we're breeding goats that have longevity, they have balance, they have structural correctness. So those types of animals are going to be the ones that are giving the most milk. In addition, we have a robust health program and vaccinations. So our goats, especially for a large herd, are really healthy and feed them really good food. And so the dairy goats are the show goats, and they're not one has been hindered by the other.
Going off of that, Danielle, I'm going to piggyback right off of that question there. How do you decide which animals to retain and which to sell? Like, is there a certain criteria in your mind whenever you're thinking of calling a certain animal based on what your needs are for your farm?
Well, it starts with the kids that are born. We try to keep the kids that we're going to retain to around 50 between all of our herds. that sometimes can be hard, especially if it's a doe year. But, you know, we are trying to also sell to other breeders and provide them with good genetics too. And so the kids that we keep are mainly based on the parents, the national champions. I mean, we do sell some too, but we probably keep fewer kids from the first fresheners than we do some of the older, more proven animals. And then as they come into being yearlings, sometimes at that point, we'll go through the herd. And if there are any that are not structurally measuring up to our standard, which is the dairy goat scorecard, and we have numerous opportunities for those animals in that we still have a good number of people that move to the country that want to have two or three goats for their family. And so if they're healthy, but they're, you know, not just going to be show quality, we have a ready market for those. In addition to some of the other farms that sell to the creamery, a lot of those are growing their herds, which ours is, you know, trying to maintain and vacillates a little bit one way or the other. And then as we get to the milking herd, we don't usually need to cull for production. Most all of our does are good producers. I would say at that point, it's more culling for issues like non-breeders or mastitis that renders the animal unproductive. And then again, there'll be some does that are great milkers, healthy animals, but maybe their udder isn't quite the show quality that our other animals are. And so we'll find homes for them either through the locals or the producers.
That's what everybody really is calling for, really. I'm just happy to hear that you also nailed down the fact that you guys tend to go by the scorecard, especially with the kids. So I'm happy that you've echoed that as many breeders and producers that have been on this show have in the past.
Yeah, well, we are a dairy and we sell the milk, but the overgrown 4-H-er in me, we do want to win at the shows. So we've got to have both. And thankfully, our goats have been really cooperative in that regard. And we've been really lucky and grateful and thrilled that over the years, we have worked with other top breeders and used their genetics and improving our animals by, because there is still no perfect goat. You know, you might have a buck that throws gorgeous udders, but the rumps are a little steep, or throws beautiful feet, but the front ends need a little more sharpening up. And so we're always looking at other herds and other animals to see where we might bring in new genetics for our own herd. And we've had great success with that, and we're really grateful to other breeders letting us have their genetics as well.
That's another episode that I didn't realize was this year. Another great episode. Great pick, Danielle. I'm going to kind of switch it up here. Episode 145, Bouncing Back. It's just with Danielle and I. I know. It's about how after your dope kids, they might have a little bit of a hard time getting back into show rig, getting it back to looking like a good, healthy dairy goat. And this episode is packed with our ideas on how to get your animal bounced back quicker and looking better for not only the show ring, but for your barn.
What other things, if you have a doe that might be putting it all into milk, that you're kind of giving her to help her bounce back and put on a little bit more fleshing?
So I'll evaluate my feed choices for her, and I won't necessarily push feed, but I'll change what I'm feeding her. So she will get, I love a good equine senior feed to add weight to a doe. And so she will get some of the normal dairy goat sweet feed that I feed, but some of her grain that she gets while milking will be that senior horse feed, because it's just a really high fat
great feed to pack on the pounds I've found for them. And maybe I'll increase her sunflower seeds as well. Again, there's high calories there. So that has all kind of helped me in the past to help those does get back to prime conditioning. Mm-hmm. What else do you do?
I give them shredded beet pulp. So like everybody knows that has been a long time listener that my doe gem was not an easy keeper. And it took me a long time to figure out how to feed her during lactation to keep and put weight on. And so for her, she gets a high fat, high calorie senior horse feed. I had a brain fart for a second there. But she also gets like a shredded beet pulp on the stand. If she's like really struggling, then I'll add a couple supplements to that and kind of just go from there. She'll also still get, you know, her hay, obviously. But she'll get, when they come in and out of the barn, they get a scoop of grain for everybody to share. So she usually pushes everybody around and gets the majority of that too, which is a higher protein. So she's still getting that protein that she needs to make milk. And we go from there. But really a good quality hay for any of my harder keepers. And I found last year shredded beet pulp is like a godsend for them. They love it. And it just fills them up more. It does offer some good nutrients for them, good fiber. And then there's also the senior horse feed. I found just do the trick.
Right. And hay is so, so important.
Yes.
And I know we've talked about it a few times with what I've done in testing in the past, and also with the episode we just did with that hay, how you can do a feed analysis and forage analysis and what the advantages are there. So it is so important. And I've seen, even with my animals as they're freshening, going from last year to this year, and just the condition they have by feeding them those alfalfa pellets while they were dry and while they were on that first cut, but then also we switch them now, because while I don't have everybody in milk, I have enough does in milk, and the does in milk need the nutrients. So I know I'm just going to have to carefully monitor the other does when they start kidding, because they are getting fed a higher quality hay earlier on, or basically before parturition. But with that, I am seeing, first of all, the strength and condition. Most of my does look really good. Bouncing back hasn't been a problem, but they're producing so much milk and they're putting all that energy into that. So they need a good, nice quality hay that meets those nutritional demands. And so going and making sure you're feeding them something that keeps up with it makes a world of difference and helps them nutritionally as well.
You were brave, John, and listened to episodes to find these clips that I was like, I don't want to listen to myself talk so much. And so I really appreciate that you did find an episode where it was just the two of us.
Yeah.
So my next clip is from episode 137, The Lucky Star Stamp, with Judy and Don Hoy. And I almost think we had this theme kind of running throughout the year that we didn't even realize we were doing, as I kind of started looking back and really focusing in on some of the breeders' philosophies and what sets them apart, and just how they create animals that really work for them and how they are driven about that. And I think this clip just really showcases that.
And early on, we didn't keep dry yearlings, and we wanted yearling milkers who could produce 2,000 pounds of milk, which was not typical of a La Mancha in those days. That was really what initially drove our goal, I mean, drove our, what we capped and what we sold, mostly, you know, what we cap after they freshened. The Lucky Star, though, you see today comes from a different process. And there's a story that goes with that, yeah, of course.
Judy, I think you should tell that story. It starts over 20 years ago.
Actually, year 2000.
Year 2000, yeah.
We had what we considered a beautiful dairy herd. You know, we thought they were really special. They were permanent champions. They appraised 90, but they were four individual does that were beautiful, not a dairy herd. One was a tricolor doe, one a chocolate pinto, one actually a black and tan, one a red. And we walked them in the ring. Now, kind of imagine the Northwest where you have Desrugistel, Tempo, you know, I mean, the quality of the herds in the Northwest is amazing. And we used to have to walk in the ring with all these national champion, first place dairy herds and compete. Well, there's no way we could compete with the Sonnens and the Togs. And we have this beautiful mahogany Nubian herd. Even the Alpines, darn it, were this uniform couture look.
Well, and Clissa's grades, yeah, the precursor.
Yeah,
to-
we always, yeah, Clissa's grades, we did, there weren't sables at that point, but even the grades were really sable Sonnens, and right, they were uniform.
Yeah.
And so here we walk in with this, you know, four pretty does, but I looked around the ring and I went, we're never going to compete for this award until our breed looks like a uniform dairy herd. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2000 at State Fair. And we came home and we said, so what are we going to do? And I said, well, let's list all our favorite La Manches. And we did. There was a Brookwood doe from Pete Snyder named Yolanda, a national champion named Zeba, Barbara Backus's Shyla, our own Crystal. And we figured out that we listed 12 and 10 of our favorites were black and tans. Huh. So maybe there was something to this color. And we decided, okay, so let's see if we can't breed for that color pattern. And maybe we'll get more of these does at our own house that we like so much. So I started collecting sales lists and writing. We didn't, you know, I hate to say the internet wasn't quite as
it wasn't as robust as it is now. That's for sure.
I collected, you know, literally hundreds of sales lists. I called people, I wrote letters, I asked for pictures. You know, there is no database for color.
No, there's not.
That's very
and
true.
So it's, you know, if you breed a color breed, you kind of got it in spades. At least you can assume so or hope so. But in the matches, we're allowed, and we're grateful for that. Every breeder gets to do their own thing when it comes to color. So trying to write to everybody, and of course, there were people who were suspicious I was up to something. But mostly I wanted a four goats that not only produced top 10 milk records, but looked alike. We collected all this data and we started breeding. We made a point of only buying black and tan bucks, which much to the delight of some of our fellow breeders, they would always chuckle when we'd call an order and, you know, and they go, well, we know what you're going to ask next. And I was accused by one of my favorite herd breeders. When we put the order in, they said to us, we've never had a black and tan born here. And I said, well, I've done all my homework and I really think that you could get a black and tan buck out of this breeding. And 5 months later, this is Martha Greiner and Bill Greiner. I'll tell on them. And Martha called us up and she said she thought maybe I was a witch. Joking and laughing. And I and we're all laughing. And I said, oh, you got a black and tan buck, didn't you? And then they laughed and they said, we got a black and tan buck and a black and tan doe. And the second doe was more traditional of the colors they had had to that point in the herd.
Then I'm going to switch it up again a little bit here. We're going to talk about retirement homes with Tyler Ramirez. That's episode 173. I think Danielle was off adulting that week. So Tyler and I just took a couple minutes and talked about something that I wanted to talk about, which was those does that are starting to age, maybe getting a little long in the tooth. What do you do with them? And this is a fun episode with Tyler to talk about.
So now I'm like, man, I really love this doe. She's rocked it in the show ring. She should, knock on wood, freshen like dynamite. Why don't I try to get another one of those? But also my thinking with all this is if when you're breeding a 10 or 11 year old doe, 12 and up, what your program in the last 10 years should have rocketed forward to where that doe is. So are you kind of, do you think that it, like, part of it is like spinning wheels at the same time? Like, you're like, well, we should have gotten better by now. Why am I breeding this one to kind of stay the same as the style from 10 years ago?
Right. I think right now with my program, I'm kind of in the opposite boat as you, mainly with my bucks, because I've been using the same buck genetics for several years now. And I have repeated a lot of breedings, mm-hmm. and I feel like I've gotten a lot of consistency that way. But with my doe kids, I don't want to say I'm stagnant with the quality of my doe kids, but recently I brought in a new buck, and I have like two or three age does that I've said are retired and haven't been bred in 2 or 3 years. But now that I've brought in a new outcross buck this year, I'm kind of interested to see how some of my older does would cross with him. So that kind of puts me in a tough position if I want to pull them out of retirement just to see what they would do with the new buck that I just brought in.
So what do you think you're going to do? You think you're going to go ahead and pull the trigger, or you think you're going to err on the side of safety?
I don't know. I'm still going back and forth. It probably depends on how loud these age does are screaming when they're in heat and if I let in, but...
I feel you on that statement. I sent you that Snapchat video the other day of Jem coming out of the barn. Well, this wasn't on the video, but she came out of the barn high-headed, which she never does. She usually kind of just lopes to the stand, jumps up, and, you know, gets to work. But she goes out, and she's high-headed, and she's walking fast, and I was like, oh, no. And she runs to the truck, which is my father-in-law's truck's parked right there. And I lose sight of her. So I try to cut her off. So she goes to the front of the truck and I walk up to her and she tries to juke move me. And dude, you saw that Snapchat. For a 10-year-old doe, she was quick, man. I was like, okay, she wants to get bred.
Yeah, girl know what she wants.
I held on.
I also do have a bonus episode. You have one more, Danielle, or are you done?
I have two more.
Oh, okay. Go for it.
So my first one is episode 157, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 with Mark Baden. And I do actually have two clips from it because...
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, because the first clip is just a lot of insights into this idea that Mark had and kind of how his animals should look and how that correlates to linear appraisal and... just a great episode in terms of kind of figuring out what direction you're going in terms of your breeding program. And once again, kind of the goals he has and how he makes that work with his program.
A real impressive class at the national show was in 2021. I believe it was the Nigerian dwarf two-year-old class. It had over 100 two-year-olds. And so how do you stand out in a sea of moon spots and blue eyes, right? So having moon spots and blue eyes may get you sales, but it's not going to get you acknowledgement or to be first. Or you have quad buck kids, and it's like, well, you would like to pay for your $35 bales of hay that you're having to buy, and you would like to sell one out of those four buck kids. Well, you need to have you know, good traits. And so having goals, having high standards, breeding for things, and then that makes your breeding program appealing to other people to improve their herd. And so for me, when I look at the teats, the 25, so our scorecard says, you know, very clearly what the goal is for teat placement. Two-thirds of the center line of the teat when viewed from the rear, the center line of the teat to be two-thirds the distance from the medial suspensory ligament. And that, you know, you can read on that on page 150 of the guidebook. That's the Mamrie system scorecard. And then also when it talks about teats, it says that teats uniform in size of medium length and diameter. So medium. So when you look at the linear appraisal program, the definition of teats of medium length and teats of medium diameter, that's a 25 score. So our score, it's not my preference. It's in black and white. It's not my bias. And so that is my goal. Now, I will say personally, my goal is I like to breed for a 20 to 20. I want teat diameter to be slightly narrower because I think that is more aesthetically pleasing than an inch and a half diameter teat on an alpine. And so to me, my other philosophy is, and I actually had a customer email me this yesterday about goat they're interested in. And their question was, well, did I think that the teats were going to get bigger? And I said, well, she freshened February 2nd. And I said, she's been in milk for over 3.5 months. I go, they're pretty much what they are. Now, you know, if you would have asked me, you know, oh, she just freshened last week. Well, they're probably going to get bigger. So my philosophy is teats, you know, before they hit, you know, peak of lactation, which when you look at CDCB and USDA lactation curves, we look at about 45 days in milk, right? For 45 to 90 days is where you're looking at for persistency. And then the lactation curve starts to gradually go down, right? Depending on where you live, you know, heat index type of thing. So when you get past the 90 days, that's probably the teat that you're going to have. So for me, I mean, my ideal goal is, you know, I think that, you know, a teat diameter of a 20, but our scorecard says a 25 is a darn good score. So why not have that be your goal?
Right. And I think about there used to be, and I don't know if it was the SOP or a marketing material for linear appraisal, used to have this ideal range of scores. And that got removed because, like you said, your goal is going to be different than my goal, is going to be different from somebody else's. But in some things, those fives, you want the extremes. You want that rear udder height, and you want that the stature and the rump width, because that is what is good extremes for you and your herd. But then some things that are those threes, you don't necessarily want an extreme. You don't want that. So just kind of a side tangent, if you go on to the ABCA Genetics site, everyone, and you go to the type evals and you start looking at the, and there's other ways to see this too, but if you click on, let's say, teat placement, you'll see this scale, and there's a 5, and then there's the 25, and then there's the 45. And so that 45, those teats are very, very close together. They're right on that medial suspensory ligament. If you go to the 5, you can barely, in that illustration, you can barely see the teats. They are right on that leg. And so there are areas of the scorecard or the evaluation for linear appraisal traits, like, as you were saying, teat placement, where your ideal is probably going to be in the middle range and be closer to that 20-25, because that is where we need to be just based on the nature of the linear appraisal and looking at going from the extremes to the middle.
We got Mark talking, and he just had this amazing clip to share as well. And so I just couldn't not highlight this once again, because just such a wonderful line.
You know, I can't wimp out on that. I mean, biggest mistake I ever made in my young career, and I said such stupid things. I mean, I said many dumb things, but I mean, I'm willing to publicly admit that to thousands of people here, is that, you know, when I was younger, I said, oh, you know, I don't care about milk production. I don't have a dairy. So what does that matter to me? I could never have been more wrong. You're never wrong to breed for production. If I didn't care about production, I'd be having to sell my excess milkers that aren't show quality for $200, and I'd be taking a $300 loss. And that doesn't add up, not in 2023 economy. And so breeding for production, even Nigerian dwarf, matters. They got to fill a cereal bowl. They don't fill a cereal bowl, they should fill your freezer.
That's a t-shirt.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and I mean it. I mean, and we need to stop coddling this. Well, no. We need to stop coddling. These are dairy goats. Embrace production. Now, not necessarily how it was embraced in the 70s, you know, where we were using the support bra all the time. Mm-hmm. The best seller back then. But still, they should milk. And beautiful show goats can milk. And the example doe, I mean, it's just like a vision. I mean, because John had asked me, well, you know, seeing's believing kind of a thing. I go, well, look at this.
And then my last moment I wanted to highlight is episode 148, Keeping Your Breed Standards High with Dr. Kurt Schnipke. And first of all, an amazing title, John, like perfect. But there is there is this clip. It's a little long, but I just think it goes to show everybody what we can do and the power and impact we have as dairy goat breeders to further the breeds, as well as just what we can do and what we need to hold ourselves accountable for in terms of breed standards, but also just interesting information about breed standards. I don't necessarily want to say we're taking the kid gloves off because we've said a lot of important things, but I do want to ask and kind of let's take those kid gloves off. But what are some pet peeves that you see when it comes to breed standards for all across the breed?
Oh, Danielle, this is the polarizing question that I, am both not looking forward to and in a way looking forward to, because here's the deal. Nobody can tell anybody else what kind of animals to keep or breed, you know, if let's say you're operating a dairy and you breed Saanens and you get a bunch with big, huge Roman noses. And if you're not showing, does it matter to you? I don't know. That's not for me to say, because I'm not the one paying your feed bill, nor having to trim those hooves or give shots or manage them or clean the manure out of the barn. I think it's important to kind of take one step back and say, all of these are the standards that we should be applying to our herds, whether we are show herds, commercial herds, or just hobby herds, you know, because again, if I have a hobby herd of Oberhasli, they should still look like Oberhasli. There's a reason that I chose Oberhasli versus a hobby herd of Alpines or hobby herd of Nubians. Some pet peeves that I have, I guess I'll start with my own breed, you know, the Oberhasli. I guess the general statement that I will make about pet peeves, both personally and professionally as a judge for the American Dairy Goat Association, would be any animal that does not look like the breed that they're supposed to look like. And that's a very blasé, very PC answer there, but I'll dig into it a little deeper. So if it's an Oberhasli that does not look like an Oberhasli, then that's a pet peeve for me. And so to dive into some specifics of, you know, how would an Oberhasli not look like an Oberhasli but be showing as an Oberhasli? Well, you know, there are some things about the Oberhasli breed, such as a wide set eyes. Sometimes they're known as the perfection little redhead, or sometimes people refer to them as bug eyes, where the eyes sit a little bit more outward rather than straightforward. They're a little bit more sculpted, alert, and expressive. they have a very wide forehead muzzle that's either dished or straight. And then typically the ears, to me, I can usually tell right away, because Oberhasli ears, if you compare them specifically to Alpines, and I bring up Alpines a lot because there are Alpines that can look very close to Oberhasli, right? We have Shamwa's and or Bay Alpines that can look very Oberhasli. You know, nobody's mistaking a Saanen for an Oberhasli, and nobody's mistaking a Tog for an Oberhasli. So that's why I compare them to Alpines. And so the Oberhasli ear set typically is just a tad bit lower on the head, and the ears actually kind of tip forward rather than, I call them like perky ears or Alpine ears. Those stick a little bit more straight up. Oberhasli ears, even when they're up and at attention, you know, that kind of alert, like, oh my gosh, what's going on, or something surprised me, or I'm really looking around because, you know, either startled or, you know, I'm really engaged. And you know, we all know that expression on a Swiss breed animal's head. The ears actually kind of tilt a little bit forward, and they're set a little bit lower than is those quote-unquote perky Alpine ears that are a little bit more upright. And specifically these really long, narrow faces on Oberhasli that, you know, I look at it and go, ooh, you look a little Alpine in the face there, a little long in the face, huh? And so those are big pet peeves, because to me, that's not hallmark for the breed. The other thing that is really important to me, you know, again, maybe I'm opening a can of worms here, but I'm going to open it. You asked me, so here's the can opener, and we're going to open this, right? The Oberhasli breed is known as a moderately sized breed. And this inclination that we have for bigger is better, and bigger and longer and taller, potentially winning. And I'm not saying that wins all the time, but again, like, that's the low-hanging fruit. If you're picking, you know, among March kids, then you're putting the biggest, largest March kid, because she's bigger and taller and longer, over a more square, more correct, more balanced, maybe younger March kid. Why were you doing that? And I've seen this kind of buzz toward breeding bigger and longer and taller that certainly far exceed the Oberhasli breed standards. So again, being specific to my own primary breed, you know, when we have Oberhasli in show ranks that are, you know, approaching or matching Alpine size or bigger, I'll use my dad as an example here. And so, Dad, if you're listening, I'm sorry I didn't clear this with you, but I remember we went to a show and he looked at one and he said, oh my God, that thing's like a small pony. And I said, well, you know, that's quite large, and it's not my style, because the Oberhasli should be a moderately sized breed. You know, and one of my more famous Oberhasli does that got quite a bit of recognition for years in the show ring, she was right at 28 inches. And occasionally she would get glanced over a little bit because she was what we would call on the smaller side. She was not undersized, but she was on the smaller side. And, you know, I would have to talk with people and say, she might be small, but she meets breed standard, and she's every bit as correct, if not better, than most of the other animals out here. Not even just talking in her breed. And again, I don't say that to brag. I just say that to mean, like, we have to look at her and remember she is meant to be a moderately sized breed. And so that's okay. When you then meet the breed standard, now size really should be thrown up. And from that perspective, I'm so glad that stature has been taken out of the scorecard, simply because I think it was leading to that kind of low-hanging fruit of breeding for bigger and taller and longer. And again, it's such a pet peeve of mine within my specific breed. And you know, again, I'm very passionate about the Oberhasli breed. I love the breed, and I don't want to see them become big, huge brown goats. That's if I wanted to breed big, pretty brown goats, I would have chosen Alpines, but I chose a moderately sized bay goat, bay and black. So then other pet peeves, kind of to get off my soapbox of my own breed. I think really there's only two other kind of pet peeves that when I see it's like, well, that's kind of annoying because, you know, it might be this really super beautiful doe or buck in every other right, and then that one trait, it's like, oh man, you know, you're at that, you know, 90% of perfection or even 92% of perfection, and not that I'm appraising anything, but, you know, just thinking in a tangible number type of thing. But when you see an animal that is not meant to have a Roman nose and it has a profusely or almost offensively Roman nose, meaning Nubians would have nose envy, it's just a pet peeve because, again, that breed should not have that. Our, as I've been judging around the country, are La Manchas and Sonnets. There's just quite a few of those that I have seen with, again, offensively arched or Roman noses, that it's like, oh man, that's kind of annoying. And, you know, judge that as the level of defect with which it is. But it's also kind of, again, if you're asking for a pet peeve, that's my own pet peeve. And then the final thing that I would say is kind of a pet peeve is specific to sables. And again, I'm not trying to call out any specific breed. So those of you that breed these breeds that I'm calling out, I was asked a question. It's my opinion. That's all it is. You don't have to take it worth a grain of salt if that's all you want. But I was asked an opinion, so I'm going to give it. I remember one time I was judging a sable class. It was in the earlier days of sables being recognized by the breed. And a particular breeder brought out a sable that had basically the last half of its tail was solid gray or solid black, or maybe chalk. It was some dark color, right? It was more than 1.5 inches. And the rest of the goat was light cream. And I remember thinking, that's a Saanen with a spot. It's not a sable. There's no other color. There's no other spot. I mean, if I shave that tail right up to the last, you know, inch of the quote-unquote paintbrush of the tail, it would still be within the Saanen breed standard because it would be under 1.5 inches. And so, you know, trying to pass that off as a sable, or another example that I remember, I went to a show and judging it, and the exhibitor brought in a sable doe that was, you know, again, mostly white, and they had left the hair longer on the dorsal stripe to show me that was where there was a silver dorsal stripe. And it was very obviously silvery gray dorsal stripe. There was very obvious color. It was very obviously longer than 1.5 inches. And I said, well, this is an interesting grooming practice that you've done here. And they said, oh no, we have to do that because if we clip it off, it's white. But if I leave it on and the hair grows out, it's the silver color. And again, for me, that's sort of a pet peeve because if you're doing show goats and you have to change the clipping or management practice, and again, to each their own. Some people show their goats with long hair. That's fine. I'm not calling anybody out for any practices, but if you're changing it from the standard practice or from the norm of what you would then clip all of your other goats and leaving one patch because it grows out a different color, within that sable breed, it's like, is she really a sable, or should we just have called her a Saanen with color and put her in the experimental book, breed her back to a sable buck and really inject a lot more color into it and breed it back up that way so that it's a little bit more recognizably sable? And again, I hope I haven't like triggered anybody in any of these breeds, but I was asked an opinion, so I gave it.
Always love a good Dr. Kurt Schnipke clip. Daniel, I have a bonus here. This is number 11 for folks. This is episode 149, which was our most downloaded episode of the year. People listen to this one a lot. And that is Improving Your Herd with Danelle Wolford. I gotta say, Danelle is not only a fun person to watch on the old YouTube, she's a good person to listen to in this episode. And hey, I consider her a friend. She's really come a long way with her herd after she decided that she wanted to improve it. So it's something that you're going to want to listen to for sure. Enjoy.
Yeah, in the beginning, I just wanted to provide milk for the family, make sure my goats were fed the healthiest diet that I could find or afford. So I focused a lot in the beginning on things like balancing the minerals and supporting a healthy rumen, keeping their immune system really functional, just things like that. And we did really well. We had hardly any illnesses, healthy kidneys. So the first 10 years was a really good learning experience of just taking really good care of what we had at the time, getting the most milk out of those does. We're definitely transitioning to getting serious.
Let's talk about what serious means in that transition. What was the turning point in your program when you decided to get more serious with your program?
In my experience, getting serious just means you spend a lot of time studying traits, because that is pretty much all I've been doing the last few years, is just what kind of traits do I need that is going to lead to a productive and healthy life of my doe or buck. And what changed for me was really a leg defect that I found in one of my heavy milking lines. It was frustrating to see it passed on. And then I eventually just made the hard decision to cull that line together. By culling, I mean, we did put down the grand dam, and then we spayed the dam and her yearling kids, even the ones that didn't have the defect, because I was just over that. I'm like, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. And
yeah,
that's when I really started to study what kind of traits do we need to create a healthy goat? You know, what kind of structural things should we be striving for? It really means taking a hard look at your does and making those necessary cuts. It is really tough to look at them and, you know, admit the weaknesses that are going on. And for me, it's not as much about winning at a show or having an elite doe. It's really about questioning what I'm contributing to the gene pool and if it's ethical or not. Because I found with Nigerian dwarf breeders especially, and this isn't a dig against them because I've done the same thing, but I feel like a lot of us are drawn to the breed probably because we have smaller acreage. We're maybe new to goats. They do have fun colors, so I'll say that, you know, people are drawn to the colors, but mostly it's just the size of them is less intimidating. And so you'll just find a lot of newer breeders that are drawn to those Nigerian dwarf goats. But what I've noticed is that there's a lot of poor breeding decisions that are made that have set back the breed quite a bit. And that's myself included. So I was definitely not educated in the beginning on body conformation, and I made a lot of poor breeding decisions, and we've all done it as beginners, but I think it's important as the Nigerian dwarf breed is sort of exploding. I mean, people are just going crazy with them. I think it's really important to keep educating and encouraging others to make serious decisions about their herd management and breeding choices. Yeah. So it's become sort of more of a passion for me as I've myself looked at myself and thought, okay, these are the things I've done wrong.
We were so grateful to all of the breeders and industry experts that we had come on this year. I mean, like I said, we looked back at this list and whoa, insane. And it, not only do we put this podcast on, but we do ask a lot of their time when we're recording with them. And so having these people give up part of their busy lives to talk with us and share with us, and we in turn can share it with our listeners, is just a true blessing. And I just want to thank again everybody who has come on Ringside to talk with us, because we do this podcast, but we couldn't do it without our guests. And so again, we are just grateful for not only the guests we highlighted, but all of the guests we've had on throughout the year and in the past as well. Sure, you get that one right, but you can't get a drum roll when I need one, but whatever.
Oh, I thought the drum roll was on one of these blank ones, but it's not. The blank one was this.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Everybody, this has been an awesome year spent with you. Just like Danielle just said, I'm not going to just rehash everything that she just said, because it's true. But thank you so much for being a part of this awesome community. Thank you so much to everybody that's helped put into the show. And I hope that somehow we can make this coming year, 2024, even cooler for Ringside and even more awesome episodes. I don't know how we're going to top it. I really don't, but we're going to try.
We certainly are going to try.
Do Danielle, if the lovely folks who are listening haven't been able to find us on the internet yet, where could they find us?
Well, you can find us at DairyGoatPodcast.com. We are on Facebook by searching Ringside and American Dairy Goat Podcast. We are on TikTok and Instagram if you search Ringside Podcast. And you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to leave us a rating, give us a review. Be sure to subscribe so we can show up in your inbox every week on Mondays when our episodes drop. And it helps us a lot, and we appreciate it.
Danielle, did you see that? What was that?
Christmas.
It's Santa! This has been Ringside, folks. Have a great holiday. We'll catch you next year. Did you not hear the Santa?